The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
This blood brothering between you, Prince Midalis, and you, Chieftain Bruinhelda, will be the first in over a decade. You are not to harm the Shaggoth in no way, not even at the cost of your own life. Not that you could bring harm to the great beast anyway. Not even if you brought fine weapons in there with you. This is a test of your courage, not your warrior skills. And the test of your trust in each other. If either of you fails, then you both will surely die, and horribly. Are you prepared to begin?
What are you about, elf? Are you going to tell me or not?
You take care, Bradwarden. On the South Road, I heard rumors of the Rosy Plague.
Oh, by the demons, you say?
I know not if there's any truth to those words. More likely, they were the utterances of a gossiping fool and nothing more. But I can ill afford to take the chance, any chance, of bringing the plague back to my people. Know that if the land becomes ill with plague, the Tuelalfar will secure our borders, and none will leave for many years. Farewell.
It is the plague! It is confirmed, my king! The Rosy Plague! What are we to do?
What can we do? Lock our doors fast and tight.
Oh, but where are you then? You've not been out of your walls in days! In weeks! Are you just to sit in there and let us all die then? Are you just to stand on your walls and shoot us dead if we come too close? And you're calling yourself the folk of God? But you're just a pack of scared dogs, you are!
Join with us before all the world is fallen into darkness. Help us put the church aright and thus end the misery of the plague.
You believe the plague to be a punishment from God?
On those who have forsaken the truth.
Absurd.
Obvious. I see it, and they see it. We know the truth, and we know the source, and no edicts from Father Abbot Agrangere will sway us from that path.
You risk the wrath of Father Abbot Agrangere and all the masters of Saint Mirabel.
And you, Brother Glendonhawk, risk the wrath of Marcalo de Unaro. Which of us, then, do you believe in the worst situation?
You have gone mad.
As much has been said of many prophets. If you try to stop us, you may prove victorious, but I warn you that I will come for your throat first and foremost.
Experience the latest chapter of the Demon Wars saga in Graphic Audio. Don't miss Mortalis Part 2. Available now.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
In a broken air vent, in a bunker hidden beneath the Caucasus Mountains, a woman dressed in strips of material was waking up. Almost 2 days before, when she had awakened to find herself beaten and bloody on the floor of the bunk room, Cloudsinger had immediately engaged the implant at the base of her neck and tried to dream slice. But to her horror, nothing had happened. No jump, no transferal, nothing. She had strained her ears, listening for a trace of the singing bull roarer, its promising salvation, but all had been silent. Then, as she listened, she had heard voices. People in the underground complex, walking along the corridor, and the beam of their flashlights danced in the open doorway. She had moved quickly, despite the pain from all over her body, clambering into the broken vent on the wall of the bunk room. the one that Cain had shot to pieces. Inside, she had hidden herself from sight while the enemy went about their cleanup operation, sweeping the bunker for stragglers but failing to find her. And she had tried periodically to dreamslice, to step out of real world and into the dreaming, but nothing happened. Tucked there in the absolute darkness, beside the room full of skeletons, she had slowed her breathing and willed herself into a healing coma, her heart beating at an eighth of its usual pace. Almost 2 days later, conscious once more, she found herself alone. Cloudsinger blinked, bringing her electrochemical polymer lenses to life on the nictitating membranes that slotted over her eyes, granting her night vision in the pitch-dark bunker. She walked from the bunk room, checking each doorway in turn, confirming her suspicion that she was totally alone in the complex. Alone except for the corpse of Neverwalk, a bloody ruin where his neck had been. With none of her strike team left, no access to the dreaming, Cloudsinger was utterly alone. Alone, but alive. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terence Aselford, with performances by Thomas Penny, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Elizabeth Demery, Laura Reichert, Elizabeth Jernigan, Barbara Pinellini, Casey Platt, Ken Jackson, Margie Tompros, Tim Carlin, Joe Brack, Dylan Lynch, and Mort Shelby. Outlanders number 50, Janus Trap. Several months later, the whole of Cerberus Redoubt was in pieces, or so it seemed, when Donald Bry walked into the operations room. Exposed wiring and circuitry littered the surfaces of the three desks farthest from the door. He held two mugs of freshly brewed coffee, and as he approached, the petite-framed Skylar Hitch popped up from beneath one of the desks.
Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry, Donald. I almost knocked you flying.
Hitch was a timid woman in her 20s who stood a mere 5 feet tall. Her skin was smooth and flawless, while her hazel eyes seemed alive with intelligence. This day, she had tied her glossy black hair back in an abbreviated ponytail that brushed against her nape as she turned her head. Like the other personnel in the operations room, Skylar wore a white bodysuit with a vertical zipper. Although only a small man himself, Bry doubted whether Skylar Hitch would actually be able to knock him flying, even catching him unawares like that. He was a round-shouldered man with an unruly mop of curly, copper-colored hair. A well-trusted member of the Cerberus team, Bry acted as deputy leader for the facility. He wore his customary expression of consternation, as though always unable to find the answer to a pressing problem. The operations room itself was large and high-ceilinged. There were two aisles of computer terminals, and a huge Mercator relief map stretched the length of one wall. The map was dotted with lights of different colors that played across it like old-fashioned flight paths. In the corner of the room where Hitch worked at the dismantled computers, far away from the main door, a small chamber was set inside a larger anteroom, its transparent walls made of smoked armaglass. This was the Matrans unit, and back when the redoubt had originally been established, it had formed the centerpiece of the whole military-funded operation. The redoubt had not always been called Cerberus. Its official name was Redoubt Bravo, named, like all pre-war redoubts, after a letter of the alphabet, as used in standard military radio communications. Redoubt Bravo had been dedicated to the monitoring and exploration of the newly developed matter transfer network. However, somewhere in the mists of time, a young soldier had painted a vibrant rendition of the fabled multi-headed Hound of Hades to guard the doors to the facility, like Cerberus guarding the gates to the underworld. The artist was long since dead, but his work had inspired the people who had taken over the facility to call it the Cerberus Redoubt. Bry gestured to the mess of wiring and circuitry.
What's going on here, Skylar? I left you alone for 15 minutes.
I've located our problem. The motherboards are overheating, and it's causing the system to crash.
Bry looked at her, astonished. Though timid and bookish, Hitch was a computer expert who sometimes gave the impression that she actually thought in computer language. She was so in tune with the machinery in the Cerberus Redoubt. Over the past week, there had been several instances when the computers in the ops area froze, shut down, or provided streams of gobbledygook on their monitors. Bry had genuine concerns that a virus was attacking their computers. A group in Australia had hacked into their system and fed the Cerberus machines false data only a few months ago, but he had been unable to find any obvious coding glitches. Skylar Hitch was one of a number of IT experts who were on call for such problems, and she and Bry had spent the early morning running a series of system checks, trying to diagnose the glitch. He had left her for a quarter of an hour while he took a bathroom break and grabbed some strong coffee from the facility canteen, trusting Skylar to continue the diagnosis alone. The last thing he had expected to find on his return was three computers stripped down to their component parts.
These computers are years old. They're just wearing out.
We're all wearing out.
Around them, the morning shift personnel filed in to begin their designated tasks, working the monitoring system and tracking the various field teams.
I can keep replacing bits piecemeal, but ultimately, we should probably look at updating or renewing the whole system.
Replace what you can, Skylar.
Elsewhere in the vast complex, Grant lay in bed in a darkened room, head resting against his upturned hand, admiring the beautiful woman lying next to him. He was a huge, muscular man, and he seemed like a coiled spring even as he lay peacefully watching his sleeping companion. Grant had skin like polished mahogany, and his dark hair was cropped close to his scalp. A drooping gunslinger's mustache brushed across his upper lip, and the dark shadow of stubble was just starting to appear on his chin. Grant was an ex-magistrate from Cobaltville, whose labyrinthine life's journey had brought him here to the Cerberus Redoubt. The woman beside Grant seemed tiny in comparison to the ex-mag, but her slight frame was that of an athlete, her belly flat, tight knots of muscle visible on her arms and legs. Shizuka was a warrior born, but unlike Grant, her skin was a golden color, accented with peach and milk, and her closed eyes showed the pleasing almond curve of her oriental ancestry. She had full petaled lips beneath a small stub nose, and her fine blue-black hair was cut so that it brushed the tops of her shoulders. Shizuka was a woman of astonishing beauty, and Grant knew that he would never, even for a second, take her for granted. As he silently watched Shizuka, the woman's eyes fluttered open. After a moment, she turned to face him, a smile appearing on her lips.
What are you doing?
Just thinking about how beautiful you are.
I know what you're after, grandson.
Shizuka's golden arms reached around and pulled the huge man closer. Several floors below, in a long room at the end of a corridor that ran the length of the sub-basement, two people stood side by side, blasting shot after shot from the guns in their hands. One of the shooters was a muscular man with dark hair and steely blue-gray eyes. Like Grant, Kane was an ex-magistrate from Cobaltville whose life in recent years had been intrinsically tied to the well-being of the Cerberus operation. He was built like a wolf, firm muscles across the upper half of his body, powerful legs holding him in a rock-steady stance as he aimed at the multiple targets throughout the room. He was dressed in casual clothes, a dark t-shirt and combat pants, and his eyes shifted from one target to the next as they appeared at various positions along the length of the firing range. Standing beside him, Kane's companion was a tall woman with pale skin and dazzling red hair that fell in waves to almost halfway down her spine. The woman wore the standard white jumpsuit of the Cerberus Redoubt staff, and it hugged her tightly enough to accentuate the curves of her trim, athletic body. Her emerald eyes narrowed as she scanned the room for new targets, her bulky TP-9 pistol held before her in a two-handed grip. Bridget Baptiste was an archivist-turned-warrior who excelled in both disciplines. Kane and Bridget shifted their weapons toward the target in unison, their movements liquid smooth as they followed it along the rails. Suddenly, a spinning red light flashed overhead. 15 minutes had passed. The grueling training session was over. Kane stood there, his gun still raised for a few seconds, feeling the rise and fall of his chest as he brought his heart rate back to normal. After a moment, he turned to Bridget, beads of sweat dripping down her nose, her red hair damp.
You okay?
Bridget nodded, her eyes closed, a tentative smile on her lips. Then she turned to look at Kane, and her smile widened, showing two straight lines of perfect white teeth.
That was intense. What the heck setting did you use?
I got Hitch to rig up something with a little extra kick just for me and Grant. Too much for you, Baptiste?
I'll let you know when it's too much.
You know, you shape up pretty good for a bookworm.
Grant's thoughts were interrupted by the transcom at the side of his bed. He lay there another moment, just gazing up at the ceiling in the darkness as Shizuka's lithe body stirred beside him. He leaned over and activated the button to answer the call. After a moment, a man's face appeared in the tiny window display beside the little unit, smiling in a friendly manner. The man had dusky skin, an aquiline nose, and a refined mouth. Lakesh appeared to be about 50 years of age, his sleek black hair displaying just the first hints of white at the temples and above the ears. In actuality, the expert physicist and cyberneticist was 200 years older than that, having endured an extended period in suspended animation after the nuke cost in 2001. Until recently, Lakesh had physically appeared to be carrying every last one of his 250 years, until a would-be ally of the Cerberus Exiles attempted to court their favor by reversing the aging process and giving the elderly scientist literally a new lease on life. Grant looked at the screen where a tiny camera picked up his face and relayed the image to Lakesh up in the Cerberus operations room.
Yeah, go.
Grant, did I wake you?
Grant shook his head slightly as Shizuka stirred behind him and wrapped her arms around his wide chest.
I was up, Lakesh. What's going on?
We've just heard from our contact in Tennessee. The meeting's set up, and as we discussed a few days ago, I want you to attend with Kane and Bridget.
The old crew back on the clock. When do we leave?
The meeting is set for 10 o'clock a.m. local time. Could you be ready to jump in 40 minutes?
No problem. We'll see you there.
Behind him, Shizuka tightened her grip on his chest, wrapping a leg around him and grinding her hips against him.
Do you really have to rush off so soon, grandson?
Sorry, Shizuka, but it's just a simple pickup. It won't take more than a few hours.
In that case, I'll wait right here.
When Grant arrived at the operations room 35 minutes later, washed and shaved, he found the large room to be a hive of activity. Lakesh had spread a series of papers across his desk that included several maps of the area around the recently destroyed ville of Beausoleil, Tennessee. Beside him, the red-haired Bridget Baptiste was glancing over specific items of interest. Bridget was dressed in a shadow suit now, a one-piece black body stocking that appeared to be so thin as to be a second skin, and yet the fabric had remarkable properties. The shadow suit worked as a self-contained, self-regulated environment, and the weave was strong enough to deflect a knife blow or other blunt trauma, but could not redistribute kinetic shock. Off to one side of the room, Grant's longtime partner Kane rested against a desk near Cerberus physician Reba DeFore. Like Bridget, Kane was dressed in one of the remarkable shadow suits, as was Grant himself. Kane had added a thick belt with a heavy copper buckle to the suit, along with a pair of combat boots, and on the man's right wrist, Grant could see the familiar pressure-sensitive holster containing a Sin-Eater handgun. Grant had added his favored long black duster over his own shadow suit, its dark Kevlar weave reaching past his knees. Like Kane, he wore the familiar weight of the Sin-Eater pistol at his right wrist, tucked out of sight, just a little bulge beneath the sleeve. The weapon was a legacy from their days as magistrates in Cobaltville, a position that Grant had held for almost 2 decades prior to his exile at the Cerberus Redoubt. Kane had been his partner in Cobaltville, and the pair of them had defected together, along with archivist Bridget Baptiste, after stumbling upon the first hints of the Anunnaki conspiracy. Appearing as gods to early man, the Anunnaki had, from the shadows, guided the course of human history over the subsequent millennia, with an ultimate agenda of utter subjugation. Recently, the Anunnaki royal family had revealed themselves on Earth once more, and Kane and his colleagues now found themselves in a deadly war of attrition against this seemingly unstoppable foe. Crouched at a desk beside the anteroom that held the Metrans unit, Donald Bry and one of his technical team, a petite woman whom Grant had seen around a few times, were working through a bunch of wiring amid what looked like the remains of a half dozen computer terminals. Grant pointed to the tangle of wiring.
Morning, Lakesh. Trouble with the Matrans?
No, thank goodness. Just general problems with the old computers. Emphasis on old.
Happens to us all. Some of us more than once.
10 minutes later, after looking over the paperwork that had been assembled for the mission, Grant, Bridget, and Kane were standing within the Matran's chamber, ready to blast themselves through the ether in an instantaneous transition from Montana to Tennessee. It took the blink of an eye to strip them down to their component atoms and fling the essence of their very beings across the country. And yet, no matter how many times he experienced it, Kane swore that he would never really get used to traveling by Matrans. Kane had added a denim jacket, a washed-out black turned gray, over his shadow suit. He opened his eyes and looked around the Tennessee Matrans chamber, its standard tiled floor and ceiling with the familiar smoked armorglass walls all around. The armorglass here was tinted an odd color, and Kane knew from the color alone that he had not been here before. With the typical paranoia of the pre-Newcost military mind, the Matrans network, now over 200 years old, used a simple color-coding system to establish location without any explicit indicators. There were Matrans units hidden in ancient military bases scattered across the old United States of America, and many others worldwide, including similar units developed by comparable military groups for other nations. The Matrans units digitized an individual and thrust him or her across quantum space to a chamber at a programmed destination. In the intervening 2 centuries since their development, the network had remained largely undiscovered, with only a small number of people aware of these hidden gateways scattered across the globe. Kane and the other Cerberus operatives considered the Matrans a useful part of their arsenal, although traveling by it was still a disorienting and alien experience to the human body. As his roiling stomach settled from the instantaneous journey, Kane glanced left and right, checking that his 2 colleagues had passed through the Matrans gateway intact. Grant lay to Kane's left, his dark skin shining with beads of sweat. While he had grown more used to travel by Matrans, the man still had a deep-rooted dislike for the transportation method. All muscle, Grant was an ominous presence on any mission. To Kane's right lay Bridget Baptiste. Bridget had put a loose-fitting suede jacket over her clinging shadow suit, and the scuffed, shabby-looking jacket gave her ample freedom of movement. Her ankle boots were a matching brown to the jacket, and she wore her compact TP-9 pistol in a low-slung hip holster. A pockmarked leather satchel, also brown, was hanging at her opposite hip, its strap slung across her body, cutting a line between her breasts. Tensing his wrist tendons, Kane drew the Sin-Eater blaster into his hand. Less than 14 inches in length when fully extended, the 9mm Sin-Eater folded in on itself to be stored in the holster above Kane's wrist. The holster reacted to a specific tensing of the wrist tendons, powering the pistol automatically into the user's hand, where, if the index finger was crooked at the time, the weapon would begin firing automatically. The trigger had no guard. As the official sidearm of the Magistrate Division, the need for such safety features had been considered unnecessary. A magistrate could never be wrong. Though schooled in the use of numerous different weapon types, from combat blades to dragon missile launchers, both Kane and Grant felt especially comfortable with the Sin-Eater in hand. It was an old friend, a natural weight to their movements, like wearing a comfortable and familiar wristwatch. With their weapons drawn, the trio exited the armorglass room. Although the facility was deserted, the lights came on automatically as they found their way along the corridors toward the exit. A bank of powerful generators located in the underground complex had begun channeling power through the redoubt automatically as soon as the old sensor units had detected that the Matrans had been activated. It was standard protocol for these old military facilities. Bridget Baptiste took the lead as they made their way to the main hall of the redoubt. She was blessed with an eidetic memory and had scrutinized the plans of this facility in preparation for their Matrans jump here. Now she could recall every detail of its construction from those blueprints merely by calling them to mind. In less than 10 minutes, the group stood shoulder to shoulder at a huge door leading to the outside world.
Everyone ready?
To one side, a dusty old desk stood behind a pane of armorglass with a grill in its center. The computer sat atop the desk, long since inactive, its monitor stained with the greasy black charring of smoke. Bridget nodded while Grant put a finger to his nose in silent acknowledgement of Kane's question. Bridget typed the code into the old push-button pad to unlock the door. Having holstered his Sin-Eater, Grant gripped the lever near the huge door. Kane stepped toward the 3-foot-wide gap at the far right side, with his gun held in the ready position. His old point man sense was on alert as he peered through the gap and into the Tennessee morning sunshine.
Welcome to Beausoleil, people. Let's try to keep things friendly out there.
Kane edged sideways and made his way out of the redoubt. They had journeyed to Tennessee at the request of Reba DeFore on what could loosely be described as a mercy mission. During her recent inventory, Reba had noticed that supplies of their standard immunization boosters were falling low. With the devastating radiation storms that had accompanied the new cost, the whole landscape had become a near-lethal hot zone. Even now, more than 200 years after the last bomb had been dropped, there were still dangerous pollutants in the air and pockets of radiation scattered across the globe. While the atmosphere was far cleaner than it had been, the use of immunization boosters remained standard procedure for anyone involved in field work. Many of the medications in use by Cerberus had actually been produced in the vills of the Nine Barons, who had ruled over America until very recently. Black marketers with connections to the Vills remained a convenient source of immunization boosters when necessity demanded it. A few months earlier, the Barony of Beausoleil in the Tennessee River Valley had fallen in a devastating air attack orchestrated by Lilitu, a would-be goddess whose ambition was matched only by her unquenchable bloodthirst. Beausoleilville had been razed, leaving a vast number of refugees and a blossoming secondary market in salvage. Just a few weeks earlier, Kane, Grant, and Bridget had been involved in tracking genetic material that had been stolen from its ashes and had fallen into the hands of a criminal gang on the Pacific coast. Now, once more, the three Cerberus warriors found themselves tracking down material taken from the devastated Ville. Only this time, it promised to be a far simpler mission, or so the Cerberus desk jockeys would have them believe. Bridget glanced up at the sun and checked her wrist chron before pointing to her right, up the bank of the muddy slope.
Ohio's people said she'd meet us about 2 clicks to the north.
She strode up the muddy incline and made her way toward a rusty chain-link fence that surrounded the redoubt's hidden entrance.
Lead on, Baptiste.
The beautiful woman ducked through a gap in the fence and made her way across the puddle-dotted fields beyond. Kane and Grant followed.
She knows what she's doing, Kane.
I know. I just don't like dealing with these bandit types. It never ends well.
Grant pulled himself through the gap in the fence after Kane. They found themselves on a grassy hill that sloped gently toward the distant Tennessee River.
Way I see it, what it really comes down to is you can't trust anyone. First rule of survival.
You're still thinking like a magistrate.
It's kept me alive so far.
That and having me at your back.
Ohio Blue was a tall, slender woman in her mid-30s, with thick, long blonde hair that was styled to fall over her right eye. She wore a shimmering sapphire dress that reached almost to her ankles, with an enticing slit revealing almost the entire length of her left leg. She sat, legs crossed, on a crimson cushioned recliner set in the middle of a vast boathouse located on the banks of the Tennessee, in an area that had once been called Knoxville. Surrounding Ohio Blue and the recliner were approximately 50 large crates and 20 well-armed guards. The boathouse was solid on three sides, while the fourth was open to the mighty river itself. There was a sunken area in the large structure where boats could be docked. With a graceful shrug, Ohio swept her luxuriant hair over her shoulders and stood up, offering her hand to Bridget. The hand was sheathed in a silk glove that stretched all the way past the elbow in a shade of blue that precisely matched the color of her shimmering dress.
You must be Miss Baptist.
Baptiste.
Kane and Grant stood a few paces behind Bridget, flanking her with arms crossed, their sin-eaters hidden once more in their wrist holsters. Ohio Blue swept her hand casually toward them, a smile playing across lips that were painted an ice blue to match the highlights of her sapphire dress as it caught the light with the movements of her curvaceous figure.
Huh. Good to meet you. And here's a pair of handsome things. Companions or employees?
A little of both.
The art of the deal was in making the other party comfortable, and Bridget knew that she had better make this black marketer happy. If Reba DeFore's estimates were correct, the Cerberus personnel would be needing these shots before the month was out. Kane and Grant took up positions to the sides of the open area of the boathouse as Ohio Blue sat back down on her crimson cushioned recliner.
Sit down, Miss Baptiste, and let's talk business. I understand that you're in the market for some pharmaceuticals.
That's right. I'm looking for some specific jabs, the kind of stuff they were producing in Beausoleil before the,
A terrible thing. Truly terrible. My brother died in the attack.
I'm sorry.
No matter. Many a good business opportunity has come out of that disaster, as I'm sure you're aware.
K- Kane and Grant warily scanned the vast room. The place was damp. There was green mold scabbing over the walls and the wooden floor planks, and the lighting was inadequate for such a large room. There were several broken windows high in the walls of the building, and the whole place felt cold and dank. Guards patrolled all around, armed with subguns, heavy rifles, and pistols. When he looked up, Kane spotted a half dozen more guards walking across the tops of the highest crates, and two more just standing there, their blasters trained on the negotiating parties below. He turned to Grant, catching the man's eye.
We're very outnumbered.
In response, Grant just nodded and beamed a bright smile. Bridget opened up her satchel and showed the trader its contents.
What is this? Some kind of joke?
50 gold coins, exactly as requested in your communique.
Blue held one of the ancient coins before her visible blue eye, and for a moment Bridget half expected her to bite down on it, like an ancient day pirate testing the genuineness of a gold piece.
We've traveled quite some distance to obtain this merchandise.
I need more.
You're upping the price? But all I brought was 50 pieces.
70.
What if I take less? What does 50 get me?
Nothing. Deal's off.
Wait. I can get 70. I just don't have it here.
A wicked smile crossed Ohio's thin lips as she stared at Grant.
Perhaps we can work out a trade.
What kind of trade?
One can always use more employees.
Grant's not for sale.
I'm not talking about a sale, Miss Baptiste. I'm not a barbarian. A simple trade is all. Your impressive friend there for the items you wish to acquire.
Bridget appeared to be giving the matter some serious consideration before she finally shook her head, her red tresses flowing back and forth with the movement.
I'm afraid I can't let Grant go right now.
In which case, you'll be leaving empty-handed.
Ohio stood up from the couch. Bridget matched her move and offered the woman her hand once more.
It was nice meeting you, Miss Blue. 70 coins. My people will be in touch to organize another meeting.
Blue nodded her agreement, and Bridget walked back through the makeshift alleyways of stacked crates, with Kane and Grant falling into step behind her.
Swing and a miss. Could have stayed in my bed.
You almost ended up in someone else's, Grant.
As they neared the door, Kane flinched an almost unconscious movement, and his arm swept forward in a blur, shoving Bridget to the floor.
Down!
Grant scrambled to cover between the crates. Kane rolled beside him. As they powered the sin eaters up into their hands, Bridget ducked behind the stacked crates across from them, pulling the TP-9 from its holster.
This is crazy! They had us outnumbered! Could have killed us at any time! Why now?
The shooting stopped, and Kane flicked his head out into the space between the crates, taking in the scene in a fraction of a second before ducking back behind cover.
It's not us they're after, Baptiste. I think someone's come to speak to your new friend.
At the back of the cave, the assassin who moved like a ghost waited patiently as Decimal River's fingers played across the laptop's glowing keyboard. At the other side of the low-ceilinged cave, Cloud Singer's eyes flicked to the ghost woman, still wary of her despite all that had happened in the months since she had found her way back to the original tribe. The woman, the assassin whose warrior name was Broken Ghost, had such an air of stillness about her, of utter calm, despite the tenseness of the situation, that it made Cloudsinger uncomfortable. The woman's flesh seemed almost washed out compared to the café au lait complexions of the other members of the tribe. Her braided black hair and dark eyes gave Broken Ghost a striking appearance unlike anyone else in the tribe. She had painted her face with subtle blends, adding the illusion of shadow, intensifying her cheekbones, making her sharp-angled face appear almost skeletal, and she had weaved bits of glass and small, sharp chips of rock into her thick hair. She wore a loose undershirt that left her lean arms bare, their tight, corded muscles visible. Her skirt was really just two strips of material, one in front and one in back, that dangled to her knees and left her firm legs unencumbered. Cloudsinger looked down at her own body, perversely unable to stop comparing herself to the magnificent warrior. By contrast, Cloudsinger was just a girl, 16 years old, with all the energy and suppleness that that granted, but none of the raw power of the formidable woman at the back of the cave. She wore her warrior's garb, as she had done ever since returning home to the outback, a tight strip of material stretched across her small breasts like a bandage, with more strips across her groin and legs, wrapped around her arms and encasing her scarred knuckles. Once upon a time, those strips of material had been the pure white of the clouds for whom she sang. After the massacre in Georgia, of which she was the only survivor, the strips had been washed with the blood of a squealing boar while Cloud Singer slit its neck, squeezing its life out of it, until the material was dyed red. After that, despite protests from the elders of the tribe, Cloud Singer had refused to remove her warrior clothes, to the point of even bathing in them in the underground pool that the tribe used. Only alone, in her few moments of absolute solitude, had she stripped out of the strange uniform, and then only to be naked. Until the mission was complete, she would never wear anything other than her warrior's garb. She had promised that much to never walk as he lay there, head lolled at that dreadful angle, the dried blood splashed all about him in the underground bunker in the Caucasus Mountains. Decimal River's head turned right, then left, looking at the two women on opposite sides of the cave. He was a young man, just a few years older than Cloud Singer, and his left arm was decorated with tattoos of circuitry. He wore baggy shorts and a loose shirt open to the waist. The shirt was dark with sweat and clung to his dark skin where its folds touched him. His hair was braided like Broken Ghost's, and his face showed a nasty scar from a burn across the left cheek, stopping just shy of his eye.
They've used their slicer.
Not slicer. They call it something like a man's name. Matt Trans.
57 minutes ago, they activated the Matt Trans, crossing from their home in the Montana Mountains to Tennessee.
Broken Ghost took a single pace forward, and she seemed suddenly much more imposing as Decimal River looked up at her from his seated position.
Prime the trap.
Cloud Singer smiled. Soon the original tribe would get its due. Soon they would have their revenge on Cerberus and its accursed leader. And then Lakesh would die. Kane mentally assessed the immediate area around the crates where the three Cerberus warriors had taken cover. The exit door was 10 paces ahead of them, and there was certainly enough cover to escape the boathouse if they wanted to.
It's always the same with these bottom feeders.
What do you see out there, Kane?
People in diving suits. Frogmen armed to the teeth. They were rushing in from the open dock.
You want to get out of here?
Nah. Let's go make friends. Cause some mayhem.
Kane stood, reached up, and pulled himself up the stack of crates beside him. As Kane climbed, Grant hunkered down and stalked off into the shadows, his black duster helping him blend into the darkness. Bridget took a different route toward the opposite side of the boathouse, weaving through the crates at a fast trot, the TP-9 held high. As she ran, she rooted around in her satchel with her free hand, producing three small metallic spheres like ball bearings from its hidden depths. As Kane pulled himself to the top of the stacked crates, he saw one of Ohio Blue's men up there stagger backward toward him, an oozing red stain across his chest where he had been riddled with bullets from below. Across from him, on a nearby tower of crates, another guard was falling over his own feet, a gout of red gushing from a large wound in what was left of his skull. Whoever the newcomers were, they were well trained. It took some nice pinpoint work to take out the high guard so quickly. Kane pulled himself over the lip of the crates and, keeping his body low, stalked across the towers as flashes of gunfire continued to light the floor below. The body of another security guard lay sprawled on his back close to the far side of the crate tower, a single red-rimmed wound between his staring eyes. In an automatic gesture, Kane's left hand reached down and closed the dead man's eyes as he passed. Kane dropped, lying flat on his stomach, and crawled the last few yards to the edge of the tall tower. His head popped forward, and he peeked over the side as the gunfire continued below him. It looked as though a miniature war had erupted down there. In heavy helmets and diving gear, a dozen men were working as a team, using long-nosed pistols to take out Ohio Blue's guards as they approached the beautiful trader where she cowered behind her crimson recliner, bullets flying all around. As Kane watched, the tall blonde trader reached beneath the bullet-riddled recliner and produced a long-barreled revolver from its hiding place, taped to the underside of the couch. It was a Ruger Security 6, a silver six-shooter with enough stopping power to drill through a WAG door. Blue hadn't been cowering, Kane realized. She was using the recliner as cover while she armed herself. In a flash, Ohio Blue raised the Ruger, steadying the butt with her free hand. The man staggered from the gunshot. Then, to Kane's surprise, the frogman shook his head and continued walking toward Ohio Blue, almost as though nothing had happened. Ohio's guards were also having little success, and Kane now saw why. The divers were wearing bulletproof vests over their diving suits. A moment later, Ohio Blue's six-shooter was out of bullets, but it took several pulls of the trigger before the beautiful woman realized. She tossed aside the useless weapon and ducked back behind the crimson recliner.
We want her alive!
On the crates above, Kane sighted down the length of his sin-eater, focusing on the rearmost man in scuba gear. After a moment, Kane's finger stroked the trigger. Kane watched as the man's hands reflexively went to his mask, but he was already dead. His companions watched him fall. A grim smile crossed Kane's lips, and he pulled himself back from the edge of the crates, rolled to one side, and made his way to a new location. With his back flushed to the crates, Grant scanned the area until he spotted Ohio Blue crouching behind her recliner, muzzle flashes reflected in the sapphire blue of her dress. She was too far away and too out in the open for him to reach safely. He would need a distraction. Grant activated his contact, a top-of-the-line communication device that had been recovered from Redoubt Yankee years before.
Kane, Bridget, the traitor's in trouble. I can't reach her. Any ideas?
Be careful. They're wearing some kind of armor that deflects bullets.
I'm just getting in position now. I'm going to give our guests a little light show.
Grant knew what that meant, and he pulled a pair of sunglasses from the inside pocket of his coat, put them on, and covered his ears.
Count us in, Baptiste.
Bridget Baptiste was hunkered down in the shadows of the towering crates, close to one of the high walls of the boathouse. She had placed a pair of dark lenses over her own eyes, just as Grant did. Her head was steady, and she watched the group of frogmen swarming around the main area of the building. Swiftly, Bridget assessed the floorboards between her and her target. They were rough in places and a little warped here and there, but they were basically flat and smooth enough for her purpose. She drew her arm back, holding the three silver spheres in her hand, assessing their weight as she gave one last look at the scene. Then, her arm arced forward, low to the floor, and she released the three globes as her arm continued its fluid sweep. The three spheres rolled to the open area beside the recliner. Bridget engaged her contact once again as one of the intruders spotted the Grands.
3, 2, 1.
Atop the crate tower, even through the polymer lenses of his darkened glasses, the dazzling explosive burned into Kane's retinas. But he blinked the pattern away and leaped from the high crate and out into the open. A moment later, Kane was in the open area of the boathouse. He swiftly recovered into a fighter's crouch and began targeting the men in scuba gear. The flashbang was a miniature explosive device designed purely to shock and startle an opponent. The explosive was all sound and light, but the charge itself was so tiny as to be worthless as a demolition device. The flashbang was standard equipment for Kane and his team, who often saw the benefit to using non-lethal force to restrain or completely halt an enemy. The divers were all pulling at their masks in their sudden blindness. To one side of the recliner, Ohio Blue was sitting on her backside, an enticing sweep of bare leg visible where her dress had fallen about her. Her blue-gloved hand was held over her eyes and her shoulders heaved as though she were crying. Off to Kane's left, Bridget was securing the area, her TP-9 raised as she checked every nook and cranny before moving closer to the main action. A few of Ohio's guards were still alive, but they seemed to be wounded almost to a man. Grant joined Kane from his hiding place among the crates, fists swinging at the closest two frogmen. Kane turned to Grant and nodded his approval.
Not exactly subtle.
Pulling the hand blaster from another frogman and throwing it aside, Grant lifted the man off his feet and tossed him toward the nearest stack of crates.
I'm getting too old for this shit.
Kane aimed his sin-eater at another blinded frogman.
Just aim for the head.
Bridget joined them then, looking around as Kane and Grant made short work of the final few intruders. She crouched beside Ohio Blue, placing a steadying arm around the woman's shoulders.
Can you hear me?
Ohio nodded, looking in the direction of Bridget's voice with vacant, bloodshot eyes.
We're getting out of here!
Suddenly, all three Cerberus warriors spun toward the front of the building, where the exit door was located. As the dust began to clear, the vehicle stood revealed. It was a square block on caterpillar tracks. Four abbreviated arms stretched out to either side of the vehicle, two on each side with a stack array, each containing three large missiles along its length. The muzzle of a gun stood out low in the rounded nose of the vehicle, swiveling left to right as it searched for a target. Men swarmed in through the hole in the wall that had been created by the tank, armed with rifles, pistols, and shotguns, aiming at the few remaining guards who were hidden among the crates.
We're gonna need another exit!
Baptiste, you've studied the maps. Any ideas?
Bridget looked around the boathouse, and her eyes stopped as she came to the sunken area that dominated its center. Letting go of the stunned traitor at her side, Bridget dashed across to the safety rail that surrounded it and peered into the lower area. There, bobbing in the choppy waters of the Tennessee River, was a long powerboat, painted blue and shaped like a dart.
Perfect. Come quick and bring Ms. Blue!
Grant, Kane, and Ohio Blue made their way toward the area where Bridget waited. Kane kicked over the recliner as he passed, using it for a shield while they retreated from the approaching gunman. At the far end of the boathouse, Kane could see the odd-looking tank trundling slowly forward.
Oh, this had better be good.
When Kane turned, he saw that Ohio Blue was at Bridget's side, trotting down the short staircase that led to the sunken dock. Grant waited at the head of the stairs, providing cover with his sin-eater.
Keep moving, Grant.
Grant drilled a line of bullets into the edge of the lowest crate in a nearby stack. Under the relentless attack, the crane began to sag, its structural integrity ruined, and then the whole tower swayed. As the down stack blocked the gunman, the two X-Mags turned and rushed down the staircase. Ahead of them, Bridget stood beside Ohio Blue in the dart-shaped boat, swiftly assessing the vessel's dashboard controls. Grant stepped into the boat with Kane just behind him. A moment later, Bridget powered the motorboat out of the boathouse across the undulating waves. A wall of water cascaded around them as the boat turned sharply and arrowed down the choppy waters of the Tennessee. As Bridget manned the wheel, Ohio Blue rubbed at her face and looked at the three Cerberus teammates.
I am grateful for the help.
Who were they?
Competition?
See, this is what you get when you jack up the price at the last minute.
In reply, Ohio Blue just gave him a cold smile as the boat carved a path through the waves away from the boathouse.
I guess my brother's not quite as dead as I thought.
You have somewhere else we can go?
That place was an empty shell. It was just for show. You think I'm foolish enough to invite interested parties to my stock?
I figured you just lost maybe 20 men back there.
Men can be replaced. They were slow and stupid, so they died.
You very nearly died too, sister.
Ah, but you saved me, oh handsome prince. What can I ever do to thank you?
She was mocking Kane, and he knew it. Bridget steered the boat toward the muddy bank. They were over a click away from the boathouse already, and no one was chasing them as far as Bridget could tell. They didn't need to keep running. When Kane looked at her quizzically, she nodded toward the verdant slopes in the distance. The redoubt was nearby, its Mattrans unit their quickest way home.
Well, it's been a blast, Ms. Blue, but this is our stop.
Oh, leaving so soon? Well, how will I ever take care of myself, oh handsome prince?
You'll manage, and I'm not your handsome prince.
A wide smile crossed Ohio Blue's cerulean lips then, that playful fire back in her visible blue eye.
What else would I call you? I never did learn your name.
Kane.
Ohio Blue reached out and pulled him back by the arm.
I owe you, Kane. Tell Miss Baptiste that she will get her meds, and at the original price.
Kane's steely blue-gray eyes looked at her, and a lopsided grin crossed his mouth for a moment.
That's a very noble gesture.
I remember who my friends are, Kane.
In a few moments, Kane joined Grant and Bridget on the banks of the Tennessee.
She'll give us the booster shots for 50.
You do have a way with the ladies.
I'm not so sure. Friends like her almost always turn out to be more trouble than they're worth.
Shizuka sat cross-legged on a blanket spread on the ground of the empty plateau outside the entrance to the Cerberus Redoubt. She had dressed in casual clothes, a loose-fitting cotton blouse in a pink so pale as to be almost white, black trousers, and flat, open sandals. The mid-morning sun played across the exposed skin of her arms, her throat, and face, letting her mind fall silent with stillness. She had brought two items with her that seemed, because she was dressed so casually, very much out of place. A katana blade, 25 inches of sharpened steel, held within a dark scabbard beautifully decorated with gold filigree, and a small wooden casket, just 6 inches by 3, like a music box. The sword and box rested on the blanket. She had been thinking of Grant, that aching need to be in his company, to share nothing more important than the simplest of moments. But between his commitments to Cerberus and hers to the Tigers of Heaven at New Edo, the couple never quite seemed to have enough time together. Indeed, some of their most significant shared moments had been during the heat of raging battle. This day, for the first time in months, had seemed to her to be the free day she longed for, with the demands of her role as leader of the Tigers of Heaven quiet for once. And with typical bad timing, Grant was required on a mission halfway across the country. She flipped open the brass catch on the little wooden box. She would wait for Grant, so that they might yet spend the afternoon together with no distractions. Shizuka's delicate hands pushed open the lid and reached inside the box. Its contents had been placed carefully inside specific compartments, a masterpiece of simple design and economic use of space. There were sheets of thin rice paper, a soft square of cotton, a lightly chalked powder ball, and a small bottle of oil. Along the front of the compartmentalized box rested a tiny brass hammer, held separate from the other items in the cleaning kit. Shizuka reached forward, taking the sheathed katana from where it lay on the blanket. Gripping the hilt of the sword with her right hand, she pulled at the scabbard with her left. She looked at the blade for a moment, her eyes scanning its length, observing the grain of steel, checking for flaws. Then, careful to hold the sharp edge of the blade away from her, Shizuka took a single sheet of the wafer-thin rice paper and began to slowly stroke the blade with it. This was a necessary process, a chore that every samurai going back to the days of feudal Japan had performed to ensure that his katana, often referred to as the soul of the samurai, remained strong and clean, free from defects that might hinder a warrior in battle. But it was also a ritual, one that served to fill and calm Shizuka's mind as she awaited her lover's return. Shizuka became aware that someone had approached and was standing behind her. She tilted the sword just slightly, looking in its reflective surface between the dustings of chalk to see who it was who had come upon her with such stealth.
Domi!
Hi, Shizuka.
Domi cut a figure like no other. She was barely 5 feet tall, with a tiny waif-like frame. An albino, Domi's skin was as white as the chalk that Shizuka used to dust her blade. Her hair was also white, with the slightest variation in color, like paper turned to ash, and cut short in a pixie style that framed her face. It was within that face that Domi's most unearthly feature resided, however. Her eyes were an angry, vibrant scarlet, like pools of blood, and seemed to burn into the soul of whomever she looked at. Domi had appeared from the undergrowth around the plateau, dressed in a pair of denim shorts cut high to the leg and a drab green abbreviated halter top that barely covered her small, pert breasts. Her skin and bare feet showed a few marks where dirt had brushed against them, and Shizuka saw the bow and quiver of arrows strapped to Domi's back. The young woman had been out hunting, not for any real reason beyond the pleasure of the early morning solitude and the thrill of the chase. Domi was a true child of the outlands, often distinctly out of place around others, and a born survivor. Like Kane, Grant, and Bridget, Domi had joined the Cerberus operation via a disrupted life in Cobaltville, in her case as a sex slave to the repulsive Guanateague. Since then, she had become a highly valued member of the Cerberus crew. Domi gestured to the blanket spread across the ground.
What are you doing? Picnic?
Only as food for the soul.
As Domi stood watching her, Shizuka reached for the bottle of oil and dribbled a few drops along the blade. Then she tilted the katana so that the oil ran along its length. With her free hand, Shizuka took the cotton square from the wooden box and began to clean the blade.
You want maybe some food for the stomach, too? 'Cause I'm heading inside, and I wouldn't outright object to company.
Shizuka waved her blade before her, feeling its familiar weight in her hand as it swept through the air. Looking up at Domi, she smiled.
That would be nice.
Making certain that they were not being observed or followed, Kane led the way through the gap in the chain-link fence and stood there for a moment, waiting as the others stepped through and followed. According to his wrist chron, it was almost 1:30 p.m. local time. The back and forth of their little escapade had made it a 3-hour-plus effort. Still, with the instantaneous transportation of the Mattrans, they would be back in Cerberus in a few minutes. They had plenty of time to catch the lunch shift at the canteen and grab themselves a proper meal. They had left the heavy door slightly open when they had passed through earlier, and rainwater had already pooled across the flat concrete flooring that stretched out into the lobby of the abandoned underground bunker.
Do you and Shizuka have afternoon plans, Grant?
Silly question.
Halfway around the world, in a cave that was hidden from the late afternoon sun, Decimal River watched a blinking light flashing on his laptop screen.
They're inside the Mattrans.
Activate the trap.
Across from Broken Ghost, Cloudsinger felt a tiny shiver run up and down her spine in anticipation. To her irritation, the shiver reminded her of how it felt back when she could activate the implant, back when the Dream Slicer still took the original tribe into the dreaming world, before the Cerberus people had blocked their access with the master weapon, the Death Cry. Decimal River watched the numbers on his screen race toward zero as the Mattrans unit was activated in Tennessee.
They've primed it. Just a few seconds longer.
Beside him, her head jutting forward as she watched the countdown, Broken Ghost remained utterly expressionless.
And zero.
Close the trap.
Kane was stretched out on a leather couch in a small office, the walls of which were painted a reassuring, rich butterscotch.
And could there be any particular significance to the name that you chose for the operation, Magistrate?
He opened his eyes and turned toward the man, sitting in a chair beside his head, peering over his regulation glasses at Kane, a notepad resting on his crossed legs.
I'm sorry.
Beside him, the man thumbed back two sheets of his notepad, and Kane saw the tiny scrawl that covered each page.
Cerberus, you called it. The Hound of Hades. Do you think that has any particular significance?
I don't really remember. What were we talking about?
Are you still perhaps confused after the gas attack? Magistrate Salvo told me that you were lucky to get out alive.
Kane closed his eyes, letting the words wash over him as he tried to remember. It had been a regular PPP, a pedestrian pit patrol down in the Tartarus pits, which sat at the very bottom of Cobaltville, surrounding the administrative monolith. He and his partner, Grant, had been accompanying some newbie, he couldn't remember the name, checking ID chips and generally making their presence known, when someone had launched a burning bottle of something flammable, a molly, in their direction. It had been a long time since the pit dwellers had openly attacked magistrates like that. There had been explosions and blaster fire, and a smoking canister had almost exploded in his face. After that, it was all lost. Kane couldn't remember anything.
How's the newbie? McKinnon?
I'm afraid Magistrate McKinnon died.
As he lay back on the couch, Kane's eyes wandered around the room once more. Despite the relative safety of the surroundings, his point man sense was alert. He felt as if he was being watched, and not just by the psychiatrist who sat patiently beside him. There, in the far corner of the ceiling, a little black blister, no bigger than his hand, contained a surveillance camera. You were never truly alone in Cobaltville.
What about my partner, Grant?
He was still in surgery when you came in here. Would you like me to go check?
Something was wrong, Kane knew. Some instinct deep inside him felt unsettled. Maybe the gas attack had affected him, just as the psychiatrist had said.
That's okay.
He pushed himself up from the couch and smoothed back his dark hair as he gathered his thoughts. Beside him, the shrink checked his wrist chron.
We still have almost 20 minutes before the session is over, Magistrate Kane.
Kane looked at him, standing in the dark t-shirt and combat pants of an off-duty mag, the muscles of his tanned arms flexing as feeling returned to them. He felt as though he had been sleeping and was only now awakening.
I think I'm going to duck out of this one. You've been a great help. I'm better now.
The psychiatrist looked like he was about to complain, but Kane stared through him, placing his dark-lensed glasses over his eyes, becoming an emotionless magistrate once more. The whole culture of the magistrate system was built upon intimidation. Everything they did, the way they dressed, the way they carried themselves, even when off-duty, was designed to instill fear in the people around them. They were the last bastions of order in a world that had tipped close to utter chaos, and their authority was absolute, their judgment incontestable. The psychiatrist stood up, and Kane could see the little beads of sweat forming on his brow as he peered into Kane's dark lenses.
Well, I wouldn't wish to waste any of your precious time, Magistrate.
No, I'm sure you wouldn't.
Kane shucked into his regulation black ankle-length Kevlar weave overcoat, the familiar red shield of office attached to the lapel.
Good day, Doctor.
Oh, good day to you, Magistrate.
Kane walked along the corridors. Above him, the grand structure of the administrative monolith towered high into the sky, brushing the clouds that languished across the Colorado plains. Off to the west, the sun was sinking, a rich orange ball as late afternoon turned into evening. Staring at the windows, he thought back to the discussion he had with the shrink.
Cerberus, the Hound of Hades.
The name seemed familiar, and even as he thought of it, an image flashed in his mind. A woman's face, her porcelain skin beautiful and clear, her hair a flowing tumble of red curls, her glowing eyes like twin emeralds reflecting flame.
What the fuck does that mean?
Grant tried to open his eyes, but they wouldn't open. He felt so lethargic, and yet strangely, he was utterly awake. Then there was pain. Pain so intense, so absolute, that it threatened to overwhelm him, consume him. He tried to clench his fists, but was unsure if his fingers moved. He calmed his mind, remembering the techniques they had taught him years before in magistrate training. A magistrate is never ruffled, never swayed by emotion. The pain was in his right leg, high in the leg, a line of pain across the top of the leg, close to his groin. He felt as though he may have blacked out and had lost his immediate short-term memories. Even in not remembering how this came about, he still recognized the symptom, the feeling of bewilderment. The pain continued, a blazing sensation that felt so strong across the top of his right leg. Pain equaled danger, which meant that Grant needed to be awake, needed to find out what the pain was, what was going on. He struggled once more to turn his head and open his eyes. It seemed impossible, but suddenly the pain became worse, went beyond absolute into a whole new level of agony that Grant had never even imagined existed. He felt the muscles of his mouth strain, stretching open, trying to scream, yet no sound would emerge. And suddenly, his eyes were open, assaulted by light so bright that it stung to look. His vision blurred immediately, salty tears streaming across his eyes, rolling down his cheeks. He struggled, blinking the tears away where he couldn't move his hands to reach them, and he saw properly for the first time where he was. He was safe. He was on his back, bright lights around him. People bustling about in familiar starched uniforms of the Cobaltville Medical Hub. It was hard to see beyond the lights. Everything was lost in comparative darkness, but he could smell the disinfectant, the antibacterial wash. He counted 7 people in the room with him, reduced to silhouettes by the overhead rig of fierce lights. As Grant watched, he began to discern their features, his eyes getting used to the bright halogen lighting. They were looking at him intensely, with concern and furrowed brows. They were looking at him, but not at his face. They were staring at his legs. Grant tried to look down the length of his body to see what had transfixed them, but he found that he couldn't move, couldn't make his body react. The pain in his right leg burned and ached, but he could not see why, could not see what was going on. One of the doctors leaped back from where he stood at the foot of the gurney, and Grant watched as a fountain of blood flew up and splashed over the doctor and the other people there.
Damn!
Grant saw the instrument glinting in the lights. It had a blade of some kind and a cable that led to a socket in a portable machine.
Doctor! Doctor, look! I think he's awake! The magistrate is awake!
In the name of the Baron, where the hell is that anesthesiologist? He shouldn't be awake for this. Put him out, Elaine.
Tears swam across his vision, and Grant saw the blur of a figure dressed in white rushing closer to his face. She was reaching toward him, her hand a pinkish, blurred shape. Suddenly, something hard was pushed against Grant's face, wrapping itself around his mouth and nose, coiling and shaping itself as though it were alive. And the woman, the nurse, was pushing her hand against his forehead, holding his head in place.
Upping feed level to 3.8.
The sensation of pain in his leg was abating, and for just a second, the thick tears seemed to clear. Grant saw the nurse close to him, leaning over the gurney as she turned her head away from him, checking gauges as she worked. Her white uniform was starched, with perfectly creased lines down its edges. The uniform was unflattering, but Grant could see that she was a curvaceous woman, the tunic straining against the swell of her breasts. She turned back then, looking at Grant. His eyes seemed to see only her smile for a moment, white and dazzling in the lights. She had large white teeth, with the canines poking beneath the edges of her lips, which were the color of burnt umber. Grant's vision swam, and he looked at the nurse's face, trying to make sense of it. 2 dark, watery, deep brown eyes were looking back at him. Her beautiful, flawless teeth showed as she smiled, following the curvature of a long muzzle poking toward him, her pink and black nose twitching slightly amid the rusty brown fur. Grant realized then that the nurse looked like some kind of animal, a dog, a German shepherd, or maybe a timber wolf. And as he looked up, gazed across the room, the surgeons and the other nurses and personnel in the room all appeared the same. He was being operated on by dogs,